Hey, y'all. Let's have an AA meeting. All right. My name is Jackie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Please let's share a moment of silence while we think about why we are here.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Judy, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes, in his or her own language and from his or her own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." So now I have the privilege of introducing Siobhan. Siobhan, I met years ago, and I couldn't believe that this little Irish sprite had ever had a problem in her life, ever. However, I picked up a card for her tonight, and it's much more appropriate than I had realized. It has a rose on it. But, as we know, yeah, roses have thorns, but Siobhan proves that thorns have roses. Her background was thorny, but she stuck with it. And as you will notice, any of us who have stuck with it, you newcomers, will find that our lives are so much better. No one has come to this podium and said, "I have 10 years and it's so much worse." We are so grateful. So we hope you newcomers will pick up what you need and know that you're not alone. And here's Siobhan.
Hello. My name is Siobhan, and I am an alcoholic. I didn't know I was going to be standing up and speaking into a microphone, so I'm going to get my bearings about me here. I ran into Tim. Where's Tim? Tim, about a month ago, very early on a Sunday morning, and we looked at each other, and I was like, he's got to be a recovering alcoholic because it's the crack of dawn on a Sunday morning, you know, and recovering addicts tend to get up early, so. And he asked me if I would be willing to share my story. And I said, yeah. And he said, I'll send you some dates. And he gave me this date. And I was like, my higher power is pretty amazing. Yesterday was my 25-year sober anniversary. And the gift for me to be able to share my journey in sobriety, like right after, a big birthday, you know, was I was like, wow, that's just one of the many, many synchronicities I always get with this program. And I also wanted to kind of start with just a prayer that my higher power and your higher power just use me to carry the message of this program, because I will forever be grateful to AA. And I take, like, any kind of service, whether it's speaking or leading a meeting or whatever, it's very, very serious to me. I have so much respect for this program, and I have so much respect for you all. I really do. This is, not everybody finds recovery. And for many, many years, I've wondered, like, why? My sponsor reminds me, figure it out is not one of our slogans. But I think The older in sobriety I have gotten, the more I believe in my body, in grace, that there is no figuring this out, for me anyway, you know, and without a doubt, grace and a lot of footwork have kept me sober, but I have to give the most credit to my higher power and to just grace. So, the format, and please forgive me, I'm going to apologize ahead of time if I cuss, but in the email I got from the other Tim, he's like, you know, please watch your profanity, and sometimes I slip up, but... So, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Atlanta, in the city, at Georgia Baptist Hospital, and grew up in Midtown. And I was born the youngest of five kids, two of which passed away very, very young. So I was the youngest of the three remaining. And my father was... I have been told he was the kind of he was a director in the theater, and he, from what I've been told, was the kind of man that books are written about, like the genius tortured late stage alcoholic. He was an alcoholic as long as I knew him, for sure, and very what I have learned with kind of active alcoholism and narcissism kind of go together. So he was alcoholic, narcissistic, early 70s. And my mom was with the Atlanta Ballet for a lot of years, and also alcoholic, narcissistic, early 70s. They were both very invested in the arts and themselves and alcohol. So there were three of us little kids in Midtown growing up amongst that. And I remember, like, we were very wealthy in culture, but very poor on paper. Like, there was never things like... I mean, I had to learn... I had to learn so much in life, like things like healthcare, insurance, budgets, pay your bills, make enough money, balance. These kind of things were... They never factored in, ever. But I was always involved with the theater as a little kid, and, you know, huge cocktail parties and more cocktail parties, and it was interesting. It was funny, a few years ago, a friend of mine came in from New York, and I took her to the house in Midtown that we grew up in, and all of a sudden I had this memory of me, my brother, and my sister saying to our mom, "Can we go streaking?" And she said, "You have to wait till the sun goes down." And we waited till the sun goes down, and three little kids under the age of seven, we threw off our clothes and went streaking through Piedmont Park. At the time, I never thought twice about it. And then as an adult, I was like, holy... I almost slipped with profanity, but I was like, it was so unbelievable to me. I work with kids. Every day I work in a school. And the fierce protection I have for those kids, like, you know, it's certainly borders codependent, but, I mean, I feel very protective of them. And my niece and my nephew, I'm like, oh my God, the thought of anything like that. But that was normal for us. My parents were not, they were alcoholic, you know? They were self-involved, and kids, we were kind of in the way. But there were a lot of things, you know, like in these cocktail parties, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and God bless us children that grow up in it, because there's not a whole lot of protection, there's not a whole lot of care. So I really... suffered at the hands of, you know, some of my parents' friends. And I think what happened to me, like, at the age of five was I don't know how or why, but I saw that I had to watch my own back. And I think I lived in a constant state of bracing, and fear, total fear, because I knew, I mean, who know, I didn't know what could happen, but I knew a lot of bad things had happened. And it was very frightening, and I was always in this state of brace. But yet the dynamic that was going on, because, you know, alcoholism is a family disease. My role was to not talk about it and to make sure my parents felt okay and comfortable. And that is such a hard pattern to break. But that's what was going on. Just lots of unmanageability in drinking. I mean, it's alcoholism. I guess we all kind of know what that's like, you know? Not good for little kids. And then when I was 7, actually, my sister and I found my father dead in my bed. He had died of alcoholism in his 30s. He was 39. And we found him. It was August 1st we found him. And he was kind of purple and turned funny, but we were so used to seeing him passed out that we just kind of poked at him and laughed and went and watched cartoons. Like it was nothing out of the normal for us. And then, obviously, later, we found out that he had died. And the autopsy was, he had the body of a much older man. So he had pretty much pickled himself. I mean, I can remember my dad, like, taking vitamins with scotch in the morning. And it's so funny. Like, all that stuff seemed so normal to me until I got to AA. And then I was like, oh, my God, you mean you didn't grow up like that? So anyway, that was kind of devastating. But again, as a little kid, you know, growing up in the disease of alcoholism, I mean, I ate it. I ingested my sadness. I ingested the pain. I ingested the confusion. My mother had, at that point, already been diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer. And she had already, like, gone away and come, but she'd gone away for treatment. She just left one day, and our father said, well, you know, your mom's sick, but she'll be back. And again, as a kid, that was terrifying to me. But all I would do was brace, because there was nowhere safe to go. Or, you know, temper tantrums and things like that, and, like, crying for my mom, I couldn't do that. That was not part of our family dynamic. So when my father did die, my mom was, she was dying of cancer, and she had these three little kids. And so the message that I got was, it's not that important what you feel. It becomes about survival. And so then by the time I was 11, my mother finally passed away. She died also. And so it was me and my brother and my sister. And we became wards of the court and went to live with this family. And it's going to be shocking, but family of alcoholics and addicts. And, you know, they knew my parents, and so they had similarities. And, again, there was just not a lot of safety or care or concern for kids. I mean, that's the thing with alcoholism, you know. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I know, like, when I'm using, not a whole lot else matters. And certainly caring for people, caring, you know, God, of course not caring for myself, but caring for other people and just being awake, forget it. So that was... Again, I braced and I was terrified. I didn't like these people. I knew they did drugs. I just was like probably in a state of shock as well. So that was age 11. And then this family had a lot of their children who were older also living in the house. So it was like this chaotic house, people in and out and just chaos. So when I turned 12, one of their older children, who was probably in their 30s, which again, today when I look back, it shocks me because, again, I work with kids, and to pressure a 12-year-old to drink, it shocks me now. But back then, it seemed normal to me. So when I was 12, I had my first drink. And my first drunk I thought I had hit the jackpot. I couldn't believe, I mean, talk about a painkiller. It was love at first vomit. I mean, the very, very first time I ingested alcohol, I mean, the pain was gone, the terror was gone, I wasn't bracing. I mean, I thought I had discovered something, like other people didn't know about this. And I drank so much that very first time that I literally did throw up and pass out. First time. And I think she had me drinking Schlitz malt liquor. Is that against this? Can I mention specifics? I was 12. And, yep, Schlitz malt liquor. That was a favorite back then. Because it got you drunk fast. And when I came to the next morning, I was like, oh, bring it on. Bring it on. I mean, that became the mental and physical obsession and allergy took hold of me. I'm not kidding you. I mean, it's literally, it's textbook. It took hold of me. It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. And I think even that next day, I drank again. Well, the thing about the house that I was living in, they didn't really care if we kind of came, stayed late, or prayed. So I was off to the races. And I pretty much began to drink every day when I was 12. And then if you offered me something, or if I was with somebody that had something and it had the hope of altering how I felt or taking away any bad feeling, I became like the like an experimental mouse hitting the lever, like the rat that won't stop using a drug. That is the way my addictions go. I am 0 to 10,000. And because I think I had no I had no upbringing and had never witnessed like how maybe some people or families operated. Like I didn't know I was supposed, I didn't have a care for my life or anybody else's life. That had not been installed in me. So I used a lot. I failed out of two high schools, never went to school. But, you know, like I had discovered my painkiller and I was not going to give that up. And during that time, from like 12 to 18, it was, well, you guys know. I mean, you're recovering alcoholics and addicts too. So, and imagine a 12-year-old kid that was kind of like, I mean, I guess in some respects, we were like feral animals. You know, there really wasn't any kind of structure or care. So by the time I was 18, I still had one more year of high school to go. And there was a man living in this house of these people that I was still living with. And it had gotten so bad with him that he was threatening to kill me. And I believed him. I, now, being a dewy-eyed graduate student of mental health counseling, I can say he was probably sociopathic and for sure alcoholic addict, but he was threatening to kill me. And I thought, this was probably one of the first times that I can look back and truly pinpoint that I kind of knew something is guiding me here, because I had been through some pretty rough alcoholic situations, but this one was like, I was like, oh, now he's going to kill me. And I had an aunt, my mother's sister, who lived in Pennsylvania, and I called her one day and I said, can I come then finish, can I come up there, and I have a year left of high school, can I come finish high school up there? And she said, yeah. So my sister and I, in the middle of the night, left that house and we drove up to Pennsylvania. And I show up in this upper middle class white bread neighborhood, and like I show up like smoking and hungover and stuff, and it was like beyond culture shock, shell shock. But at this point, with my alcoholism, I had had several medical ODs. I had never overdosed and died, obviously, but I had overdosed on different chemicals. So alcohol really became my staple at this point. So here I am in this brand new neighborhood with, you know, an aunt I didn't really know, by myself, and the kids, like, at the high school I was going to, I mean, they thought I was wonderful because, you know, I was, like, hell-bent on death and partied, like I had a death wish. And I did. I didn't consciously know that, but I didn't have a value for my life at that point. And it was funny because my aunt and her family, like, they thought they could dress me up and get me tennis lessons and stuff, and didn't really work out so well because I'd show up drunk from, you know, the tennis coach and stuff. But during this point, now I know, like, with alcoholism, there's a bell curve. And at that point, I began at age 19 to hit late-stage alcoholism. Every time I drank, I'd go into a blackout. And I'd come out of these blackouts. One time I was in downtown Philadelphia, and I came out of a blackout, and I was getting mugged. Like, I was talking to my muggers, and I come out of the blackout, and I'm like, oh, my God. Like, you know, blackouts are freaky. Like, nobody, if you haven't never had a blackout, like, you can't explain it. Like, it's the brain basically stops. And I come out of blackouts, like, naked, not knowing where I was or what was going on. And, of course, like, I kept drinking, even though these consequences were very harrowing and frightening. But I couldn't stop drinking. It was the last painkiller I had left, and I couldn't fathom not drinking. Then my physical tolerance, I would drink. Just ingesting a little bit of alcohol would put me in a blackout. It was unbelievable. But that apparently is a textbook of what happens during late-stage alcoholism. And I literally can remember praying to God, saying, you can't take alcohol away from me. You can't take it away. I've given up with all these other things. Like, it was frightening to me at that point to think about living without alcohol. I couldn't fathom it. But I was in that land of, I can't, but I can't not. And that is such a rough place to be. Finally, my aunt was like, you're in bad shape here. And she took me to see an addictions counselor. And this woman, I'll never forget her, Diane Shields, an older woman. And I was sitting in her office, and for the first time ever, I had, like, kind of leaked out to her some of the things that had happened in my life and happened to me. And she looked at me and she said, if I call and reserve a bed for you today, will you go to treatment? And I was like, do you really think I need to? And she's, yep, mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay. You know, and so I went. June 21st, 1990, I went into detox in a treatment center in Pennsylvania. And it's back when insurance actually was worth a damn, and I was able to stay there for 30 days, where most of the 30 days I was like, you know, I'm pretty young. And back then, like, I was 19, and I think at that time the treatment center I was going to, they were just beginning to talk about an adolescent center. So it was kind of like, I mean, now today it's so amazing to see 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds coming to meetings and wanting to get sober. But back then, like, I was 19, it was kind of weird, you know, and I was in with all adults in treatment. But it was, and again, a lot of the time I was like, I can't do it. I mean, I'm 19, I'll watch Dallas every Friday night. Like, I can't fathom it. A lot of you are too young to know what Dallas is. And I wanted to leave a lot. And I would find, you know, oftentimes like try and leave or think I would leave, and but I didn't. I stayed, and I had some really good counselors there, and my 30 days was up, and I can remember they took us on a field trip from the rehab to a meeting, to an AA meeting. And I came back and I was so angry because I was like, you got to be kidding me. Like, I don't know how this is going to keep me sober. Like, I mean, I was angry. I was panicked. I was scared because I'm like, you can't put me back out there and tell me to go do that. Like, I wasn't getting it. And they were like, yeah, go to meetings when you get out. So I got out, and I did the whole intensive outpatient thing. And I, when I first got out, for maybe my first 2 years of sobriety, I went to mostly three meetings a day. I was so freaked out. I mean, I had no concept of life or living. I mean, from utero to the age of 19, I had been steeped in alcoholism. That the alcoholic way of life, which, you know, doesn't teach you a whole lot of ease, balance, and grace in life. So I got out, and I was on my own. So I'm 19 years old, newly sober. My aunt was like, best of luck to you. I had a brother and a sister. I think, at the time, I didn't know where they were, but I figured, I knew my sister was in Atlanta. I didn't know where my brother was, so I'm out there, like, as if I was a newborn, and in some respects, I really was. And I went to AA at least three times a day, and I have to tell you, I will never, ever be able to express my gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous raised me. I mean, God bless the people. When I first showed up, I decided to stay in Pennsylvania and to kind of stay close to this rehab. I stayed in Reading, Pennsylvania. And, you know, God bless the people in AA that really looked out for me back then. And it's funny. Only, not from virtue, but from absolute fear, I did what I was told to do. I got a sponsor. I did a ton of service. And again, I'm telling you, I think I was in a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder, so it wasn't as if I was making a conscious choice to do these things because I am such a saint. I was like, I don't think I want to die anymore, but I don't know what the hell I'm doing. So I did, like, and back then, you could smoke in meetings, so literally emptying ashtrays. Making coffee. And it was funny, when I was in rehab, one of the things they said was like, and we don't recommend you date for a year. And I'm like, oh no. Alcohol, drug. No, that one? Mm-mm. But God, my higher power, like, talk about grace. I rode on grace. And I did all these things. It wasn't even that I was, like, willing or virtuous or anything. It was grace. I can't explain it. It was grace. I don't know. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I have such levels of defiancy and, I mean, you guys know you're alcoholics too. Like, but I did all that. Lots and lots of meetings, sponsors, service. And I'll never forget my very first sponsor. She said to me one time, Siobhan, you are finding God. You're finding your higher power. And I'm like, how does she know that? Like it was some kind of secret or something. I don't know. I don't know why. I guess because I always felt, you know, from being profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism, others and my own, I felt invisible and as if my life and I didn't matter. And so for somebody to point out something like that to me was shocking and startling. But I was beginning to find God. I mean, I was drinking the AA Kool-Aid. I had to get a higher power, and I had to find out, like, I had to make that work. I felt as if I didn't have another choice. And so, that first year of sobriety, I don't know how, because my high school transcripts, as you can imagine, I mean, literally, I still have them, and when I look back at them, FFDD, absent 76 times, tardy 102 times, but somehow I got in. I didn't know what to do or where to go or what to do with myself, but I had heard other people my age talking about college. No one ever mentioned the word college to me growing up, ever. But because I didn't have anywhere else to go, I thought, well, I'll go to college. And again, grace, I got into Penn State my first year of sobriety. And so one of the things I have found out about myself being an alcoholic and an addict is I'm compulsive as hell. And when I'm sober, I can do a lot. And so, I mean, I was running like 16 miles a day, and I started getting straight A's and going to meetings, and I was stark raving sober, quite frankly. And I still am a lot of the time, but yeah, they had told me in rehab, actually, they said, so, Siobhan, you are a high-energy level person. So for some people, reading a book is relaxing. Other people need to build houses. You're going to need to build some houses. So we hope you like to maybe find exercise rewarding or something. I'm like, okay, yeah. And so anyway, at Penn State, like I did straight A's, you know, straight A's. And I had met this girl from rehab who was staying in a halfway house after rehab in Reading, and she was from Vermont. And one day she said to me, drive to Philadelphia with me. I want to check out this college, Bryn Mawr. And so I was like, okay. So we're driving in. We're on the main line in Philadelphia, and, like, it's beautiful. And I look over, and I see this little, it looked like a little castle. And I'm like, what's that? And she's like, that's Rosemont College. That's an all-women's Catholic college. And I'm like, I'm going to go there, because you can't get more gooder than going to an all-women's Catholic college. And I'm good now. I'm good. I'm going to erase all that, and I'm just going to be good. And so I applied to Rosemont College. And again, you know, things like student loans, a 19-year-old that is basically 2 years old, dealing with and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I applied to Rosemont College, and I'll never forget, this woman calls me on the phone. She was the registrar, and she said, yes, Miss Wade, you did very, very well at Penn State, but you're going to have to explain your high school transcripts to me, because I'm going to have to go before the board to get you in here. And I was honest with her. I said, I am a recovering alcoholic, and I am newly sober. And, you know, so we went through the whole thing, and I got into that school. And in truth, my motive was, let me erase the fact that I am an alcoholic and an addict and, you know, perhaps don't have the best background. But I think, well, my belief is my higher power took me there, because it was so, I was like this, it was such a safe, lovely little place, and it allowed me to kind of unbrace my system. And the first thing I did when I moved there, I went to a meeting. And that's what I did. I went to a meeting. I got immediately hooked into the Philadelphia AA circuit and started going to this college. And it wasn't perfect. Like, that was one thing I was thinking about when I was praying about speaking tonight. I would do such a disservice to AA and all of us to say, like, because someone has a long-term sobriety that their life is just roses. That is not my truth at all. So I don't want to ever paint a picture like, oh, I've arrived, or it was all good because I was sober. No. I mean, it was, you know, look, I don't know about you, but I am also human. My tendency is for addiction and alcoholism, and I, to this day, have to work with my higher power and sponsors and meetings and stuff to combat my patterning. This is a harsh disease, you know, that they profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism. But anyway, Rosemont was a good experience, and I got quickly hooked into AA there. I got a sponsor there, and I did well at that school. And I to this day, I talk to some of the people from, you know, the meetings up there. Well, at some point, my brother was going to move back to Atlanta. I got back in touch with my brother and my sister, and my brother was going to move back to Atlanta. So I decided, well, you know, I got kind of a good thing going here. And I did. I was au pairing for a French family. I was a full-time student. I was a personal trainer. I was actually cocktail waitressing, which this is just, for me, like how I know grace exists, because ever since June 21st, 1990, the obsession to drink has been lifted from me. And, you know, they talk about being spiritually fit. We can go where any free man goes. And I don't necessarily, I can't say I'm spiritually fit. However, I have always been willing to grow along spiritual lines. And that is the truth. And so I was making big money cocktail waitressing, and the alcohol did not bother me at all. I had, at that point, grown accustomed to, like, going to bed at a certain hour. So things like, wow, I work really, like, late into the night. Like, that kind of, like, sober behavior, sober living had begun to take hold of me, to where, even though it was great money, it was different, because I was making the flip to living sober, you know, and not staying up all night. Anyway, life was actually okay for me in Philadelphia at a very young age. AA and God and my higher power really carried me. And I did, I mean, again, not out of virtue, but out of fear, I did what I was told to do. Well, I decided to move back to Atlanta because my siblings we were all going to kind of reunite back here. So I moved back, I guess I was about 24 or 25. And again, I did what I was always taught to do. I went to AA right away. And it was okay. It was, you know, I was readjusting and going to meetings, and I don't know, like I'm a big believer. Like I want to get well always, and I've always believed, I love therapy, I'm sorry, but I do. And now in this day and age, there's so many different forms, and they're finding out about brain plasticity. So oftentimes when I would hit glitches in my sobriety, I would also go for outside help, you know, and still, as an alcoholic and addict, I don't do well with feelings, especially when they are not comfortable. To this day, I am so much better, and I can see how if I actually let them come, they come, and then they go. It's when I, you know that page about acceptance, it's very true, and I've tested it many a time, but when I finally accept, I'm feeling a lot of pain, or I'm feeling this, when I can accept it, like it's able to move. And also, throughout my sobriety, I've always kind of had this thing for alcoholic men, which always added an extra essence of unmanageability to my sober life. So I say that just because, I mean, because one is sober, one is also a human being. So that was basically like I was doing the AA thing and establishing my life, and I finished college here in Atlanta, and my older brother and I actually moved in together at this time, and he was drinking at the time. And I think because I got sober so young, I was so overly conscientious of ever coming off preachy or like I have the answer and you need to get sober. So I would just leave like my big book and my literature around our apartment, and like he'd be coming in in the morning, and as he was coming in from a night of drinking, like, I'd be getting up to go to the gym, and, you know, we'd pass ways, and but it wasn't a problem. Again, I am very protective of my sobriety, and it just wasn't a problem for us. Well, my brother ended up getting sober, and we lived together for about 4 or 5 years, and we were both sober, and it was kind of a very fun time because we had each other, but we were still both really young, and we're doing our lives and our careers and our, you know, young things sober, and it was good. And then time came, and we had to part and kind of continue to grow up, and that's what we did. And so this is another thing that I do have to share, because it is a testimony to AA and to the 12 steps. My brother and my sister and I, because of the way we grew up and just for whatever reason, we were all very close and very enmeshed. And we had throughout the years like some pretty bad breaks happen. And a few years ago, we had a very bad break between the three of us. And oh my God, it was horrible. And we fought, and my brother wouldn't talk to me, and it was like very hard for me, very painful. And I got a call one day, and his wife told me he was in a hospital, and she said, "You need to go down there." And so he was in intensive care, and they finally found that he had congestive heart failure. And so for about 3 years, he was in and out of the hospital, and I was there with him and for him. And, I had a little triangle. At the time I was in graduate school, I would go to graduate school, I'd go to work, I'd go to the hospital, I'd go to a meeting. I'd go to school, work, hospital, meeting. Work, school, hospital, meeting. And it wasn't a martyr thing. It was like, for me, it felt as if my higher power gave me like the, it was what I was supposed to do, you know, to be there for him. And during all this time, I kept thinking, like, man, my worst fear in the whole world is losing my brother. It's my worst fear. Well, 8 months ago, my brother passed away. He finally died. And I didn't have the conscious thought of, I want to drink. But I did think to myself, holy smokes, like, I'm not exactly sure how this is going to play out for me, because this is painful, and I don't really have very many choices to numb this pain out. And I actually called the night he died. I called several program people, because I don't believe in like waking up drunk, like, you know, what is the saying, like shock drunk. Like, I think it's a process that happens before a relapse. I don't think it's like, oh, it's like things start slipping. So it wasn't as if I was like, I'm going to drink, but I was like nervous. I just thought to myself, wow, like this is, I've been through a lot of stuff and I haven't picked up, but this one like hits a part of me that is just very vulnerable. Well, I didn't drink during it, and in truth, I think it has actually matured me, and it has brought me to the point of knowing powerlessness over alcohol and people, places, and things in such a profound way that after I stopped fighting that and surrendered to really that powerlessness, again, I knew on a very deep level my only choice in life, really, is I have to continue to build my relationship with my higher power. There is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him now. Like, it became, again, not an urgency, but I kind of knew on a deeper level my life really depends upon it. And so, you know, what I have decided about death is it's my least favorite part of life. But again, it's one of those things like I am having to accept. And I swear to God, the big book is the wisdom in the big book to this day blows me away. And I still at times fight it, dispute it, try and figure it out, look for the easier, softer way. And then after I do my dance, then I surrender. But the surrenders, I feel, I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel as if they're getting deeper. So, and the thing about the 12 steps for me and AA is, you know, I'm very spiritually adventurous, and I like to learn about a lot of stuff, but I have never, and a day at a time, I don't think I will ever leave the wisdom, the safety, and the... I won't leave AA. I mean, it works, you know. And again, it's not to say that I think I had this very grandiose idea of like, oh my God, like I'm sober a long time. I should be like rich or famous or something. But I'm really just sober, you know. I'm really just sober, and I think probably very fortunate, because there were many instances as I look back that I really should have died. When I got to rehab, they're like, you have no business being alive, like let alone in treatment. And there are just all kinds of things I'm grateful for. I do. I have amazing friends and community, and I think another thing that it has changed a lot in me with sobriety and age is realizing like, success is like remembering people's birthdays and like taking a phone call when I don't want to take a phone call to be there for someone else. And, you know, it's things like that. I, again, profoundly affected by the disease of alcoholism, gave me all these grandiose ideas of what success in life should be. And I have had to continually surrender a lot of expectations and to accept, like, what is. And it's kind of cool because with accepting, as I stop fighting what is and begin to accept it, it's almost like a what is actually blossoms. So my higher power always has this very funny sense of humor with me. Like, I fight and I fight and then I go, okay, I'm so exhausted, I'll stop. And then it's like, wow, like, but that's good. You know, this is good. I could like this, you know. But I am an alcoholic, after all. Anyway, that's really all I have. I believe in AA wholeheartedly, and I believe in humility, and I believe in us as a group being there for one another. And I love that in AA there's no hierarchy. You know, like, we are all the same. And we're here for one thing, and it's, you know, to recover and to help others that are recovering. And I'm so honored to be a part of it and to be in the middle of it with you guys. So I think that's all I got. Thank you.
Siobhan, thank you so much. That was amazing. Thank you, really. I've asked Rachel to come up and give out the chips.
Hey, guys. I'm Rachel. I'm an alcoholic. In this program, we have a chip system to mark our time in sobriety, and we'll start it off with a white chip. If you want to surrender the drink just for today, you can come pick up a white chip now. And after 30 days and nights of continuous sobriety, we offer a silver chip. Got any more silver chippers? No. Okay, 90 days, red chip. Yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. And a blue chip. Do we have any birthdays, the year, or multiples thereof? I'll offer the white chip one more time.
your tribe. Things moved out of my way, running so fast and wild. After time, trouble stuck to